If you'd like a church Bible, please raise a hand and the steward will bring you one. So we're reading chapter 19 of Deuteronomy, page 197 in the church Bible. In chapter 12, we read, "These are the decrees and laws you must be careful to follow in the land that the Lord your God, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess." So today, in chapter 19, we continue looking at another set of these laws given to Moses as the Israelites prepare to enter the promised land. So, page 197, chapter 19. "When the Lord your God has destroyed the nations whose land he is giving you, and when you have driven them out and settled in their towns and houses, then set aside for yourselves three cities in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess. Determine the distances involved, and divide into three parts the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, so that a person who kills someone may flee for refuge to one of these cities. This is the rule concerning anyone who kills a person and flees there for safety. Anyone who kills a neighbor unintentionally, without malice aforethought, for instance, a man might go into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood, and as he swings his axe to fell a tree, the head may fly off and hit his neighbor and kill him. That man may flee to one of these cities and save his life. Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue him in a rage, overtake him in the distance, if the distance is too great, and kill him, even though he's not deserving of death, since he did it to his neighbor without malice aforethought. This is why I command you to set aside for yourselves three cities. If the Lord your God enlarges your territory, as he promised on oath to your ancestors, and gives you the whole land he promised them, because you carefully follow all these laws I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to walk always in obedience to him, then you are to set aside three more cities. Do this so that innocent blood will not be shed in your land, which the Lord your God is giving you as your inheritance, and so that you will not be guilty of bloodshed. But if out of hate someone lies in wait, assaults and kills a neighbor, and then flees to one of these cities, the killer shall be sent for by the town elders, be brought back from the city, and be handed over to the avenger of blood to die. Show no pity. You must purge from Israel the guilt of shedding innocent blood, so that it may go well with you. Do not move your neighbor's boundary stone set up by your predecessors in the inheritance you receive in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess." Witnesses. One witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of any crime or offense they may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If a malicious witness takes the stand to accuse someone of a crime, the two people involved in the dispute must stand in the presence of the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in office at the time. The judges must make a thorough investigation. And if the witness proves to be a liar, giving false testimony against a fellow Israelite, then do to the false witness as that witness intended to do to the other party. You must purge evil from among you. The rest of the people will hear of this and be afraid, and never again will such an evil thing be done among you. Show no pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot.
You might have noticed there was another government started this week. Many of you will know I'm a bit of a political geek, actually, so reshuffles are really exciting days as you discover who goes where and who gets what, and I was merrily sort of following it all on Twitter. Reshuffles are great. But one of the things I noticed is that many of the government departments that you get arise out of concerns that you see in Deuteronomy. Which is no surprise, really, because Deuteronomy is setting up, this is how you're to live in the land, and various things are going to be required. And so what we looked at a couple of weeks ago in terms of poverty, you can imagine being the responsibility of a Chancellor of the Exchequer or a Department of Work and Pensions and Welfare and so on. We're not actually going to be able to cover it in this series, but in chapter 20, you've got material for the Ministry of Defence as to how war is conducted. But in chapters 19 to 21, I want to look at, if you like, the Ministry of Justice. How should the law work? That's kind of where we're going in chapters 19 to 21. Justice has got two main connotations in the Old Testament. You have social justice, a call in Israel to treat the poor, the widow, the orphan, the foreigner. You know, those in particular need, they're to be treated well, they're to be cared for, they're to be treated with justice. And then on the other hand, you have what you would call criminal justice. What's to happen when people break laws and so on? Because there is the kind of realism that will happen. Laws will be broken, that will need to be dealt with. What happens when people disobey? And of course, justice remains a key issue today. We've said in this series that you can't quite go from Old Testament Israel to 21st century Britain. There are clear differences. But nevertheless, justice is something that God regards as important. And we're going to see stuff in Deuteronomy that should impact how we think about it. So it happened that as I was working on this on Friday, my phone exploded with an alert from BBC News. A lady by the name of Gemma Mitchell had been sentenced to prison for 34 years for killing, decapitating, actually, a friend in order to gain money from a will that she'd forged. Now, quite why the BBC decided I needed to know that as a matter of imminent importance, I wasn't quite sure. But nevertheless, it did remind me, okay, this is in that kind of area, actually. What's the right thing to do in instances like that, where murders have taken place? What we said throughout this series is that initially there will be applications to the church, because Israel are God's people, and that points forward to the church, but that there will at least be hints for how society should conduct itself, because it is a government that's being talked about here. So what does God say about justice? Two main points, then we'll have a brief discussion, and then I'll come back and say something towards the end. Here's the first. The innocent must be kept safe. The innocent must be kept safe. Now, there are three main elements to this. The first was what we looked at last week, and I only touched on it briefly. So, in chapter 16, you get commands for judges. Chapter 16, verse 18, appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God has given you, and they shall judge the people fairly. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the innocent. Follow justice and justice alone. In other words, as justice is going to be carried out in the promised land, it must be impartial. It must treat everybody equally and fairly. You might have seen the statue of Justitia, sort of stands actually above the Old Bailey, sort of a Roman goddess, and normally she has two things in her hands, sort of scales, kind of weighing the case, sword to carry out justice if the person is found guilty. Now, around the 16th century, a blindfold was added. Apparently, it didn't exist in Roman times. She didn't have a blindfold in those days. 16th century, a blindfold was added. Now, if you go into the history of it, which obviously fascinated me, there are sort of two elements. It could be seen as sort of social commentary that injustice was rife, and so it's the sort of sarcasm that, you know, justice is blind, you know. Or in many ways, it is a picture of what should be the case. That actually there should be a blindness to the person in front of you. You're not to judge them because of their superior social standing or because of their age or because of their race. In a sense, you get as far back as Deuteronomy. You must judge impartially. And then you have these commands in terms of manslaughter. So for manslaughter, you have these cities of refuge that are built. And here we are into the passage that Sally read in chapter 19. As they enter the promised land, they're to set aside, verse 2, three cities in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess. And what's supposed to happen is, when somebody is guilty of manslaughter, you know, they've caused death accidentally. The danger, of course, is that revenge is going to be taken. Hey, that person's responsible for that person's death, and a quick rush to judgment takes place. And so there's this city where the people in that instance are to be able to flee. I mean, an example of what might happen is given in verse 5. A man goes into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood, swings his axe, and the head flies off, hits the neighbor, and kills him. You know, there might be an outcry from the family. You know, we need to judge that guy, whereas actually the death is completely accidental. And in that instance, he's to be able to flee to this city, a city of refuge, a city where he's to be kept safe from unfair prosecution. And you have the instance of manslaughter. And then in terms of justice being carried out carefully, you have material about witnesses. Towards the end of chapter 19 and verse 15, one witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of any crime or offence they may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. And again, verse 18, you have a case where judges make a thorough investigation. In other words, you have a sense of there is never any rush to judgment. Justice is to be done carefully. Investigations are to be carried out. People are not to be punished on the basis of one person's word. That was never going to be enough. And of course, in society, before you have things like DNA and stuff, you know, witnesses were key when it came to criminal prosecutions. And it's all to be impartial, and it is to be fair. Now, let me make just a few applications at this point. There is actually an application to the church here. Now, you might think, gosh, manslaughter, judges, witnesses, this doesn't really seem to have much to do with church life. But interestingly, Paul actually quotes one of these verses when it comes to church life in 1 Timothy. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, it talks about when elders fall into sin, and the elder isn't to be kicked out of office on the basis of one witness. Actually quotes from Deuteronomy. It needs more than one witness. It needs two or three witnesses. Now, I think it's pretty vital for churches to get this one right. Now, I don't think it's the case that, you know, there's been a rush to judgment based on one witness. I think as you look at some cases in churches recently, the tragedy has been there's been more than one witness, two or three witnesses, and still it's been ignored because, hey, the leader is above repute. And actually, it seems to me that where you do have two, three, four witnesses saying this is the way the leader is conducting themselves, churches must do a thorough investigation. That's entirely right and proper. And so you do have principles here for actually how even churches will do justice. Must be careful, there must be investigations, accusations must be taken seriously. And on the basis of two or three witnesses, action can be taken. But it seems to me there are also broader implications in terms of society, and particularly this sense of justice must be fair and must be impartial. Since the 1991 Criminal Justice Act, each year a report has to be written, and it summarises things like conviction rates, sentences that are applied to people of different ethnicities and so on. And actually the reason that's put together is to check that justice is being impartial, that people of different ethnicities are not being judged differently for the same crime. Now, can I say, if you're thinking that's woke nonsense, you are wrong. That is really important. it is really important that justice is carried out equally across different ethnicities. That seems to be a profoundly important principle that emerges from something like Deuteronomy, where there's no partiality based on people's generation, ethnicity, and so on. The innocent must be kept safe. Justice must be organized and done well. And that should flow from a concern for God. You see, it's often historically, isn't it, in communist countries where you have the likes of your kind of show trials with shoddy standards of evidence and so on. Whereas if actually you have a concern for God, and if everybody is made in his image, then how you do justice will be profoundly important because you're dealing with people who matter, people who God has made. And it seems to me a state, a society will be in a better position to ensure justice if God is revered. Because actually, if God is not revered, there becomes fewer reasons to be concerned about justice. Whereas if you have a God of justice, you'll be concerned to get it right. The innocent must be kept safe. Justice must be done. But then secondly, the flip side of justice being done will mean the guilty must be punished. The guilty must be punished. Now, there's a little bit about economic sin in this section, verse 14. Don't move your neighbor's boundary stones set up by your predecessors. And basically, of course, this is the day before land registry stuff. So how do you know what's your property and what's your neighbor's property? Well, there's a big stone there. And of course, there must be the sort of temptation, mustn't it? It's dark. And suddenly your land gets a little bit bigger. And Deuteronomy is saying, no, don't do that. Because quite apart from anything else, God sees. And so there's concern for economic justice. And some of the other Old Testament books in the Pentateuch, the first five books, will spend longer on this. And as I say, we did talk two or three weeks back about poverty and so on. But the two main crimes to which attention is turned in Deuteronomy 19 are murder and perjury. Murder and perjury. What's to happen if death is caused, not by manslaughter, not by an axe head accidentally flying off? What is to be the case when it's cold-blooded murder? Verse 11. If out of hate someone lies in wait, assaults and kills a neighbor, and then flees to one of these cities, hey, it was manslaughter, the killer shall be sent for by the town elders, be brought back from the city, be handed over to the avenger of blood to die. In the Old Testament, the penalty for premeditated murder is capital punishment. The murderer is executed. And then you have perjury. And this is sort of the case of willful lying. This isn't just, I got it accidentally wrong. This is where there's deception taking place. What's to happen there? The judges, verse 18, in the case of a malicious witness, must make a thorough investigation. And if the witness proves to be a liar, giving false testimony against a fellow Israelite, then do to the false witness as that witness intended to do to the other party. Now, let's be honest, that's pretty sobering, actually. Because it is the case of, you know, here's somebody who's been accused of murder. Okay, that's the accusation. Somebody's been accused of murder. Here is malicious witness. Hey, I saw them kill that person. And it proves that that person is lying. They are to be put to death. And the reason for that is because that was essentially what they were trying to do to that person. If the person guilty of murder is going to be put to death and the person is lying in order that they be put to death, then they are to face the same punishment. And that's pretty serious. Now, there are two reasons essentially why this is the case according to Deuteronomy. In part, that's intended as deterrent. See, at verse 20, the rest of the people will hear of this and be afraid, and never again will such an evil thing be done among you. You're unlikely to be a malicious witness trying to get somebody executed if you're found out the same is going to happen to you. There is a significant deterrent effect in that. But there's a second reason, and there's a verse that comes up 9 times in this section of Deuteronomy. 9 times we read these words, end of verse 19, "You must purge the evil from among you. You must purge the evil from among you." The Bible is not naive. The Bible is profoundly realistic that there is such a thing as evil. There are people who are intent on both mistreating God, but also mistreating people that he has made. There is such a thing as evil, and it isn't to be allowed to exist within the people of God. Evil is to be purged. It's to be removed. It's to be eradicated. You must purge the evil from among you, which is why the penalties for murder, for perjury, and as we'll see, for other offenses as well, are so severe. Evil is not to be allowed to exist within the people of God. Now, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that when we looked at poverty, that as you read it, the Bible feels quite left-wing. You know, politically, if you read the stuff on poverty, it feels quite left-wing. There's a lot of measures taken so that people can't be allowed to sink into debt and be unable to pay and so on. An awful lot of stuff around forgiving debt and so on. And perhaps people politically left-wing were going, yes! On justice, the Bible's pretty right-wing. And there's no way around that, really. You know, you do get capital punishment for murder. You do get severe sentences. Personally, I find that quite challenging. Those of you who know me well will know, by personality, I'm instinctively liberal. You really wouldn't want me as a judge, actually. Oh, you murdered somebody. I'm really sorry about this. I'm really sorry to do this to you, but since you murdered somebody, you probably ought to go to prison for a couple of weeks, but I'm really sorry to do that to you. You probably don't want me as a judge because that's exactly the kind of way I would do it. And I need to let the Bible speak to my personality. Actually, the Bible takes evil and takes the value of a life probably more seriously than I do. And it seems to me that's what's going on here. Evil's to be purged so that it doesn't affect wider society. You must purge the evil from among you. Now, what are the implications of that for church and society? You might think, is there any implications of that for church? Are we about to have capital punishment within church? What's going on here? Actually, this does become the basis for church discipline in the New Testament, some of these passages. So actually, where people are guilty of not necessarily murder particularly, but some of the breaking of commandments that you see elsewhere being punished in Deuteronomy, things like sexual offenses, things like persistently rebelling in an unrepentant way against parents, being guilty of false teaching, or being guilty of causing people to worship other gods, all of which actually attract the death penalty in Deuteronomy. In the New Testament era, it isn't that those things should attract the death penalty, so much as actually those things should lead to people being excluded from the people of God. Now, of course, where people are repentant, where people have fallen into those sins but want to come back to living for the Lord, that's when church discipline ends. But actually, that is the way the New Testament takes some of this. And it is linked to this sense of you must purge the evil from among you. That where there is unrepentant sin, that where there is people saying, I'm going to live this way, and I know this is not the way the Lord wants me to live, but I'm going to live that way anyway. You can't just say, yeah, that's fine, we'll just treat you as a Christian. Because evil matters. And actually, that is to be carried out within the church. But what about society? The principle for society seems to be what you get at the end of the chapter in verse 21. Well, the principle for justice that is given is this: show no pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Now, I know you've immediately got, hang on, Jesus says something about this. He does, and we'll come back to that in a moment or two. But what I do want us to see is that actually that is basic justice, if I can put it like that. actually that where somebody takes life, them forfeiting their life is actually basic justice. Why is it the case that in Deuteronomy you do have capital punishment for murder? Well, partly because Israel is to purge the evil from amongst them, but also because that is basic justice, actually. That where somebody takes life, forfeiting life is basic justice. So I was working on this on Friday. Gemma Mitchell sentenced to 34 years, and it was clearly premeditated murder. It was clearly the case that she wanted the money from this person's will. It's very clear. And part of me just thought, in the end, 34 years isn't just, actually. What she done, she's taken a life. 34 years is not a life. There is not an equality there. There's not actually a justice there. The punishment doesn't fit the crime. There was a mass murder in the States recently, Nicholas Cruz killing 17 people in a shooting. Again, sentenced to life without parole, and the families were outraged. Hang on, my children lost their life, he still has his. That isn't just. And I know part of us is screaming inwardly because my personality is screaming inwardly, but that does seem to be the logic here. And that's why it's established in Deuteronomy. And so we see some basic principles in terms of society. We see evil matters, and we see human life matters, and the taking of human life is regarded as a serious evil. And so it matters that there's impartiality in justice. Now, forgive me, I don't think justice is something, hey, let's be gung-ho, and some of the sort of foaming at the mouth about justice does irritate me, because these are just solemn realities, serious matters. But justice involves taking evil seriously. Now, what we're going to do after the break is we are going to think about the difference that Jesus makes to all of this. So if that's your question, hold fire, we will get there. But I've got a question that, again, we might want to just talk to somebody near us about. To what extent do we take evil seriously? That's the running thing in Deuteronomy, purge the evil from amongst you. To what extent do we take evil as a concept seriously? What might be signs that we do or don't? So about 5 minutes or so, just to talk to people near you, and then I'll start talking to you again. Let's back together. Sorry, I know I've just thrown lots of cats among pigeons and so on. Normally at this point we would sing, but I couldn't really think of an appropriate song to sing after the first part. Let me do some more stuff though, and try and think, what difference does Jesus make to this? How is this fulfilled in him? And there are a couple of verses that I want to pick up, one from the New Testament and one we're going to another part of Deuteronomy. Here's the passage that I guess obviously we need to think about, which comes from the Sermon on the Mount, comes from Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus says this: you've heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth, picking up what we've looked at in Deuteronomy. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. So what's going on here? Is Jesus basically saying, oh, yeah, they got it a bit wrong in Deuteronomy, all a bit harsh in those days? No. Jesus isn't denying the reality of evil. I mean, Jesus knows all about evil. Nor, it seems to me, is Jesus denying that this is a basic standard of justice. But what he is saying is that Christians won't always demand justice for themselves. Christians won't always be saying, I want justice. This is what I should have. Because we'll see the example that he gives. Someone slaps you on the right cheek. What is a just, proportionate response to somebody slapping you on the right cheek? It's to slap them on the right cheek. That is just. You know, there's no denying that is basic justice. It's worth saying, by the way, actually, one of the reasons you have this standard of justice in Deuteronomy is that people don't exceed it. It's not the case that somebody slaps you on the right cheek and justice is to slap them on the right cheek twice, or slap them on the right cheek and the left cheek. That's not justice. No, to slap them back is justice. But Jesus says, for his people, we're not going to be about pursuing justice for ourselves. Because, of course, that becomes the pathway to bitterness, to revenge, and so on. Instead, the Christian is going to be content to be wronged. Do you notice how Jesus goes on? It's not actually on the screen. You might need to turn to Matthew 5. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, fight the case so that you hold on to... Hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go one mile, object and say, why are you forcing me to go 1 mile? No. Go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you. Do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. And so what you get here is a series of incidents where Christians are saying, people who follow in Jesus as King are saying, I'm not going to stand up for my rights here. I'm going to be content to be wronged. I'm going to be content to be put to inconvenience. I'm not going to stand for justice for my own sake. I'm actually going to be willing to lend to people even if I can't be sure that I'm going to get it back. That's the way the Christian conducts themselves. So here's a question. Should a Christian ever take legal action? Well, certainly not against other Christians, according to 1 Corinthians, but what about more broadly? Now, I can say, it seems to me there are occasions when it is right for us to take action to stop somebody who is in the process of harming a lot of people. That where actually we're saying, actually that person is causing persistent harm to a load of people, and actually to prevent other people being harmed, I'm going to get in the way and try to deal with that and object to that and maybe even use legal routes. That seems to me appropriate for us. But it seems to me what isn't appropriate according to Jesus is us saying, I want justice. I want justice for myself. I think the Sermon on the Mount is saying, actually, justice for ourselves is not something we're driving for, not something we're aiming for. If somebody slaps you on the right cheek, instead of, I want justice, I want to slap them, turn to them the other cheek also. The Christian will be content to be wronged. Why? Because we're following the example of one who allowed himself to be wronged. We're going to follow the example of one who himself follows the pathway of complete injustice. Because what we need to reflect on, of course, is Jesus' experience of capital punishment. Having reflected on that in the first part. Let's head back to Deuteronomy. Because as you get into Deuteronomy chapter 21, what you discover is a couple of other instances that feel relevant. So in Deuteronomy chapter 21, you have an instance where the local police don't manage to find out who committed the crime. So you have an unsolved murder in Deuteronomy chapter 21. What's to be done? You can't, in this instance in Israel, just say, well, hey, we can't work out who's done it, doesn't matter, because an evil has been committed, and you're to purge the evil from among you. So what do you do with an unsolved murder? Well, verse 6 of chapter 21, all the elders of the town nearest the body shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. And basically, it's a case of, in some ways, this poor heifer pays for the sin that they don't know who's committed. Blood has to be shed, and it is, but it's a heifer's blood. And it points to just a hint that a sacrifice can pay for this murder offense. And then as you go through the rest of Deuteronomy, we're not going to turn to it because we haven't got time, as I say, you do find other offences which in Deuteronomy draw the death penalty. You have things like worshipping other gods, adultery, rebelling against parents. And to be honest, as you read them, let's be honest, you kind of turn to it, your quiet time. What's going to keep me going for the day? Oh, great, the death penalty for adultery. That's really going to cheer me up this morning. And it can trouble us. It can feel wrong. It can feel barbaric. What are you supposed to do with it? Well, partly those passages are there to show us that evil matters. evil really does matter. And rebelling against God, who is our creator, the one who's given us everything, is a serious offense. You know, we talked about purging the evil from among us. One of our issues is that essentially we don't think rebelling against the God who's given us everything is a big deal, or rebelling against his standards is a big deal. And partly what's going in Deuteronomy is saying, yeah, it really matters, actually. It is a big deal to rebel against God. So what can be done? What do you do with that? Because let's be honest, as we look at things like that, particularly as the way we see Jesus apply it, we've all got problems here. What do you do with that? In Deuteronomy chapter 21 and verse 23, you see somebody who's been guilty of a capital offense, and their body is hanging on a pole, and they're told you must not leave the body hanging on the pole overnight. Be sure to bury it that day. Why? Because anyone who is hung on a pole is under God's curse. Anyone who is hung on a pole is under God's curse. That's what the Old Testament says. I don't know about you. Isn't that one of the moments when you just realize how astonishingly the Bible fits together? Cursed is anyone who hangs on a pole, under God's curse. Because, of course, the time will come centuries after Deuteronomy when God's Son will come to earth and he ends up hanging on a pole outside Jerusalem. And the early Christians saw it happen. They saw the one who was the Messiah. They saw the one who was the Son of God. They saw him hanging on a pole in Jerusalem. And they're left thinking, how? He's under God's curse. That's what it says. Cursed is anybody hanging on a pole. He's hanging on a pole. He's under God's curse. How can Jesus be under God's curse? Unless it is for us. Unless it is for us. Deuteronomy again and again says, cursed if you fall into that sin. Cursed if you fall into that sin. Cursed if you fall into that sin. Death if you fall into that sin. And then centuries later, Jesus comes and stands under that same curse and faces that same death. Why? For us. And he's cursed so that we need never be. He's cursed so that we can be blessed. He's cursed so that we can be set free. Ugh, isn't the Bible astonishing? it just really spoke to me, this. Good grief. I mean, can you think of a less appetizing bit of Deuteronomy to spend 45 minutes studying on a Sunday afternoon? And there, buried in the middle of it, is this prediction of Jesus. Cursed is everyone who hangs on a pole. And isn't the gospel astonishing? Isn't the gospel astonishing in that in the gospel you have a God who takes evil and justice seriously? You know, sometimes the way we kind of talk about the gospel, we committed that sin, but hey, God's a forgiving God. In the end, that can just be, God just brushes sin under the carpet. God's a bit like me. Yeah, you've murdered a couple of weeks in prison. That'll be good. You know, God's a bit like the kind of one who brushes evil under the carpet. But he's not. What the cross says is God takes evil really, really seriously. God takes justice really, really seriously. Evil, sin, injustice, it must be punished. It must be punished by death. So here's the dilemma. How can God, who is just, avoid putting us all to death? By becoming a curse himself and hanging on a pole. And so God is just. And the one who justifies sinners and sets sinners free because he became a curse for us. Oh, isn't it wonderful? Isn't the gospel good? Isn't the God who designed this? Isn't the God who realizes he needs to be just and also wants to set people free? Isn't the God who came up with this and just weaved it into Deuteronomy centuries in advance? Isn't he wise? Cursed is everyone who hangs on a pole, and they see him hanging there, and he's cursed so that we might be free. And that's why, you know, it's worth us thinking about justice and the implications for church. It's worth us thinking about justice and the implications for society. But in the end, it's worth us thinking about justice because it points us to a God of justice who can also set people free. Why don't you just, for 3 or 4 minutes, anything struck you from that? And then maybe in 2 or 3 minutes, I'll suggest people pray for 2 or 3 minutes, and then we'll sing our final song. So feel free to talk to each other. Yes, sorry, Keith.